welcome to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
In this week's episode, Mel and I are meeting Marion. She's a Melbourne mother of two. Marion's first pregnancy ended in a traumatic emergency cesarean following an induction due to what was termed static growth of her baby in the final weeks of pregnancy. Almost 44% of women will have their labour artificially induced in Australia, and Marion's experience is a testament to the birth trauma that can be experienced as a result of such intervention. While not every induction unfolds this way, it's important to understand the effects that the induction of labour can have on women and their birth outcomes. Years later, Marion equipped herself with a wealth of knowledge, skills, and resources in order to achieve a vaginal home birth. Marion retells of her empowerment through knowledge and the determination she has to give her baby the benefits of spontaneous labour, regardless of the outcome. The key difference between her two birth stories is the control that she takes back in her second birth and the presence of a truly informed consent. If you've personally experienced birth trauma and this episode raises any issues for you, we pop some resources in show notes for you to access. Mel and I would like to thank Marion for trusting us with your story and bringing it to so many other women. Today we're with Marion. Did you just want to start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
My name's Marion. Richard is my husband. I have Jean, who's three, and George, who's 4 months old. And we live in Melbourne.
Did you want to tell us a little bit about what your ideas were around childbirth?
I was a little, I don't know, naive, I suppose. I figured, you know, it just works. And
I chose to go with a private obstetrician
because I thought, well, I'm paying extra money, so I'm going to be getting better care. Yeah, I guess I learnt the hard way that that's not really how it works.
You said there that you felt that you would receive better care privately. What had sort of planted that seed in your mind?
Honestly, I'm not really sure because my mum was public with me and my brother. I guess everyone else, all my friends were doing it. Sister-in-law went private. It was just the done thing amongst, you know, people in my social circle. So,
did you have a recommendation for a private obstetrician?
I did. I specifically wanted a female just because I felt more comfortable with that. And I was recommended a private obstetrician. I couldn't get in with that particular obstetrician, so I went with the next person in the clinic. I never really felt comfortable with her, to be completely honest. I felt she was pretty dismissive. She kind of laughed at me a lot at my questions. Like, not laughed like out loud or anything, but just like, oh, ha 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 ha. You know, tittered at me.
Did you feel like this was because you were a first time mom, you know, your first pregnancy?
Yes. Or? Yeah. The questions I was asking for a bit.
What was that pregnancy like and what sorts of concerns were you bringing to her?
The pregnancy was completely normal, run of the mill, no issues. I did go overseas at 20 odd weeks and I was a bit worried about a DVT on the way back because I blew up like a balloon and I had cramps on the flight on the way back from America, but that turned out to be okay. And I think I had one high blood pressure reading, but that was essentially it. I felt pretty well throughout the whole pregnancy. I never had, sorry to other people about this, but I never had any nausea, just, you know, a bit of carpal tunnel and the jimmy legs at night sometimes, just do the regular stuff. I just felt, I guess, normal, but yeah, me, but pregnant.
And so take us through to, I guess, towards the end of pregnancy and what happened there and how things unfolded.
Well, towards the end, the last 2 weeks, really, I went in for my appointments and I was up to the point where I was seeing her weekly. She always did a bedside scan. She noticed that the baby had dropped in percentile, that Jean had dropped in percentile at 38 weeks and then another 5% at 39 weeks. Which she termed static growth. And so she recommended to me that sort of a better out than in attitude and that I should schedule an induction.
How many weeks were you at that stage?
I was 39 on the nose. Looking back now, I realise this was a little bait and switch situation where some sort of issue or problem is found to end the pregnancy early and to take you down a route, especially if you specifically want to, you know, go into spontaneous labour and have a vaginal birth without interventions if possible. Yeah, I just see this happening a lot, that right at the last minute there's something wrong, however small that is. And being a first-time mum, I had absolutely no idea that it was happening to me. I'm so ashamed because I'm a teacher librarian
and I teach my students the importance of research and critical literacy, and I didn't do that myself.
When she suggested it, I was alone at the appointment and I thought about it and I was like, okay, well, what do you recommend? I trust you. I believe in your trust, in your judgment. And she said she would induce. There was the wrong step. And then she called up and she made the appointment with the hospital for the next day. And so I didn't even have any time to think on it. I was just like, oh, wow, okay, well, something could be going wrong, so better get her out. I'm going to meet my baby tomorrow, type of thing, which is just really shameful in my mind when I look back on it. I guess I thought potentially that there was a medical emergency happening, so, you know, it was all for the best. And I went home and, you know, told my husband, and neither of us sort of even Googled it, which to me is just crazy. I can't believe I didn't even look it up. She just told me how it would go and what would happen in her terms. It sort of came across as a bit of a, you know, just a start, a helping hand, and then, you know, it would just go as if I'd gone into spontaneous labour, which was not the case at all. I don't know what my Bishop score was because it wasn't in my file, but I'm pretty sure it was high and closed. Going by, you know, how long my gestation with my second went, I was probably at least 2 weeks away from going into spontaneous labour. So in hindsight, it was never going to happen for me at 39 weeks. So I went in and I got the gel, and my husband came with me for that. And then he went home. We were so blasé about it, you know, because the cap, he had to go home for the cap. and then he came back in the morning for the breaking of the waters, that horrible experience, and then starting the Syntocinon. And
is that painful for you when your waters were broken?
Yeah, it was strange how when it was sort of put to me, and, you know, when you see the pamphlets, like the leaflets that they give you on it, it just seems like it's really benign, but it was really quite violating, forceful and penetrative and violating. And she did it, and then it started all leaking out and everything, and I felt so undignified. And it was then I was like, oh, okay, this was a bad idea. This isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to go. That was pretty bad.
Did they tell you how far along you were, like how dilated you were after the gel and when they broke your waters? Was any of that communication happening?
It might have been, but I can't recall, to be honest. Obviously I was dilated enough for them to break my water, so I'm not sure how dilated you need to be for that. But I didn't dilate much further from there. They hooked me up to the Synto pretty much immediately, which now I know I could have asked or demanded that step come a bit later. And it sort of was just, it was on. I went from zero to hyperstimulation.
And could you feel that in your body straight away?
Oh, pretty much straight away. Yeah, like minutes, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And it went from having no contractions or just sort of cramps, mild cramping, to what felt to me like full-blown contractions. And now that I've had spontaneous labour, some really intense contractions.
In terms of your obstetrician being there, was she discussing and explaining this to you at the time, or that had all been sort of discussed beforehand, like this will happen and then you'll feel this, or?
No, sort of, you know, we'll break the waters and then we'll put you on a drip of Syntocinon and then that will start the contractions. And it was, I guess, a more practical explanation of what was happening, but not a real lived experience of this is how it will feel. This is, you know, don't be worried about this or don't be worried about that, or it could go this way or it could go that way. I did ask before I agreed to the induction, you know, what's the likelihood of having a cesarean? And she, of course, said, well, it's a possibility, but she made it seem like it was
a small possibility.
Very small possibility. And then later on, when I asked her what her her C-section rate was, it's 30%. So if I hadn't known that, I probably wouldn't have hired her as my obstetrician. But the things we know in hindsight.
Yeah.
2020.
So take us to what happened then. You were feeling contractions. Were they building up? They were ramping up quite quickly?
They were ramping up really quickly. I read, oh God, what's her name? Juju Sundar, the birth skills book. So I had like a kit bag of things that I would do. You know, the stomping that she talks about, and I was on the birth ball, and I expected to be able to use those to sort of ease into it. And I was attached to a CTG, of course, and the CTG kept losing contact because I was bouncing around on my ball, rolling around. And this is all within, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour. And they just got me into the bed and they said, look, we're sorry, your moving is making the sensors or whatever lose contact, and so you're going to need to get into the bed and lie down. And so I got into the bed and I lay down, and that was it. It was never going to go anywhere from there. The pain just got worse, and because I couldn't do anything to relieve it, anything physically to relieve it, I was started sucking on the gas and air, and I sort of left the building. I got really, really high. Obviously, it doesn't agree with me, and I just was gone. I was having an inner monologue though, which was really awful because I was sort of in my body screaming out to stop and to also stop sucking on the gas and air. It was making my throat really dry, but I couldn't even stop to take a drink.
And were you told to stay in this position up on the bed on your back, or is it more that you felt that you couldn't move because they had to keep the CTG on?
I think the latter. I don't recall, but I don't recall voicing anything. I couldn't voice anything. They just told me to get onto the bed, and then I got onto the bed, and then I never got off, despite knowing, like, in the back of my mind that this isn't right. Like, I need to be moving. Why were all these, you know, books talking about different positions and things you can do, like getting into the shower and all this sort of thing, and I'm just on my back. But I was stuck. I was locked inside my mind. It was awful.
At this point, were you still hooked up to a drip as well?
Yes. Yeah, I was hooked up to the drip the whole time.
Did you ask for any other pain relief or anything?
We started at 8 a.m. and they came in at about 1, and my husband told them it was probably what I needed because he couldn't communicate with me. Nobody could communicate with me. My dad came in because he works in the city, and he came in and held my hand. And the only reason I know that is because there's a picture of it. Like, I couldn't even sense his presence. So, which is pretty hard to deal with. But so by about 2 o'clock, I got the epi, which I was really, really against, but I wanted sort of to come back to myself, and my husband suggested it, and I thought it was a good idea. I don't know how he got through to me, but after that happened, I was still stuck on the bed, but now because I couldn't move. So ridiculous, especially knowing what I know now, that, you know, I could have been put into different positions. I could have had help to get into different positions. I could have been on reclining on the ball, for example, on the bed on all fours. And I felt really let down by the midwifery stuff. I don't know what I was expecting. I was expecting, because I guess I was private, that I would have midwives, you know, with women. But so they came in, they checked my obs and pushed up the cinto, pushed it down. Couldn't recall their names, couldn't recall speaking to them at all, to be honest. And they certainly didn't really communicate with me. They just got me on the bed and left me there. And I remember my husband sort of just, he was sitting in a chair opposite, which is so crazy now, because for my second birth, you know, he was doing the hip squeeze and holding my hand and bringing me food, and completely different. The things you know when you know, did your research.
Yeah.
Do you want to take us to how you came to meet Jean much longer after getting the epidural in?
The obstetrician came in 3 or 4 times throughout the labour, which was only 9 hours, And every time she came in, she would recommend or say that she thought, you know, potentially a cesarean section was coming my way, which, you know, should have rung alarm bells. And I sent her away every time saying, no, I want to keep going. I want to keep trying. And my husband knew that, you know, I wanted a vaginal birth. And so he was like, yep, we're going to keep trying. And then on the last time, which was suspiciously at 5 o'clock, she basically told me that I'd only dilated 3 centimetres and the baby was asynclitic. I'd swollen, my cervix had swollen. So that was it. There was nothing they could do from here and a C-section was required.
At this stage, the reasoning being given to you was that your cervix was swollen and that was why the C-section was required?
That my cervix was swollen, that I wasn't in active labour and I was only 2 centimetres.
In terms of time, how long from that initial point of induction, how far along was this now?
From the start, from like breaking of the waters, from the real, you know, the real, I say, but, you know, people can go into labour with the gel, which I didn't know either. It was about 9 hours. So from breaking of the waters to having a C-section, it was 9 hours, which is such a short time. Considering my second labour went for 48 hours.
It's
such a short time that I can only imagine that she scheduled me for that induction so she could organize her week, and she sent me in for a C-section so she could finish up the day.
How were you feeling at the time when she said, we're going to take you into theater at 5 o'clock? What was going through your mind?
Defeated, distraught. We were crying, both of us, my husband and I. And I think we sort of looked at each other because I'd had the epidural for a while now, so I had my wits about me. And we just sort of looked at each other and we were like, this was always going to happen. Because we got driven down this path, this was always going to happen. And we sort of felt a bit betrayed at that point. I thought this was wrong. This shouldn't have happened this way. But because the labour had been so intense and the C-section was happening, I sort of just... I don't know, I went into like some sort of denial mode or some sort of this is what's happening, so this is what we're going to do next mode.
No, survival mode.
Yeah, survival mode, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, I went into survival mode and we went down to theatre and nothing was really explained by the anaesthetists, by the obstetrician. And it was very, you know, business as usual for all of them, I could tell. It was just another day in the office. This was the birth of my first child, and for them it was just another day in the office. Casual conversation and the jokes. There's a picture of my husband cutting the cord and, you know, he's making a silly face, and the gravity of the situation just was lost on everybody, myself included, because I was just so shell-shocked. Yeah, and so she was born, immediately taken away to cord cut immediately, despite me requesting for delayed cord clamping in the, you know, silly meager birth plan that she'd actually given me to fill out and, you know, sent off for observations and brought back to me all swaddled up and rubbed down, no vernix. She had quite a lot of vernix on the lower part of her body. Luckily, I guess, one of the nurses took my camera from my husband and took all these photos. We wouldn't have any photos if it wasn't for that person. But you can just see that the gravity of the situation was lost on us both. And so I got to hold her and stroke her face for a little bit. And then they took me off to recovery. And so I was there for about 2 hours, like just shaking uncontrollably from the epidural with no explanation of what was going on there either. And I didn't know where Richard was, my husband. I didn't know where Jean was. I was just lying in a recovery room, which because it's a private hospital, they do maternity and day surgeries. So I'm just like amongst a bunch of day surgeries as well.
Was anyone with you in recovery?
No, just me by myself. Doctor would come in, or nurse would come in and, you know, check on me and stuff. But I was just lying there. Alone. God, it's been 3 years and still is so raw. I don't think I'll ever get over it, ever. Which is like, it's just such a shame that that's the memory that I have of the birth of my first child. And then I went up to the ward and I was reunited with Jean and Rich. And this is ridiculous, but he went home to the cat again.
He was channeling that concern over you into the cat.
So he went home to the cat and, you know, I started the unfortunate breastfeeding journey that I had with her. Lots of nipple trauma and latching issues and low milk supply. And
did anyone assist you with breastfeeding at the hospital?
Yes. That awful cross cradle hold with the shoving the face onto the breast, that sort of really violent way of breastfeeding that thankfully now I found the Thompson method is completely different. Dr. Robin Thompson's amazing. I highly recommend her to anyone who wants to breastfeed and wants to avoid nipple pain and just really wants a gentler way of introducing breastfeeding. Yeah, so then I was just sort of on autopilot, I guess, putting all the trauma aside and getting on with it, getting on with the job of being a new mum.
Did you have any kind of debrief with your obstetrician after theatre and after all of that had happened?
At my 6-week appointment, I think I did, but it was more a matter of how I was recovering from the C-section type of thing. It wasn't, there was no debrief as I know it now. And if I look at my notes, it says happy with events.
Oh.
It's written happy with events. And I'm like, well, I obviously was just being the good patient because I was not happy with the events at all. It was only after I started to really look into what happened. I joined the VBAC Australia support group on Facebook and just started doing my own research and started to find out all the things that were so wrong about that care and what happened, why it happened, what I could have done better, what she could have done better, just all the knowledge that most first-time mums, some do, don't know, all the things that I know now and that I used to make my second much better. As soon as she was born, I knew I wanted a VBAC for, I don't even know how I knew what a VBAC was, but I knew I wanted a VBAC. There was no question I wasn't going to have an elective. I was going to try to have a vaginal birth for my second child.
You know how your doctor had said to you the reason for induction was due to static growth. What came of that? Did she actually go through that with you in the debrief and relate it back to why the cesarean occurred? And was it ever sort of justified, I suppose?
So she estimated her weight to be 3.1, I think, or 3 kilos. And she came out at 3.1. So later on when I complained to both the hospital and to her about my treatment and basically the lack of informed consent for the procedure, she said, well, I estimated her weight to be 3 kilos and she was 3.1. So, you know, I was on the money. I was correct. But there, knowing my husband and myself and our genetics and all of that jazz, 3.1, of course, was a completely normal weight. But what she was saying was that from one scan to the other, she was dropping in percentile. And then the research I'd done after she was born about, I guess, the accuracy of scans, especially late scans, are quite low, and especially scans taken within a week of each other. So, because the scans were bang on a week, and she was comparing those two scans with a scan that had been done at a different clinic. So we're talking about two scans really close together that were probably very inaccurate, and then compared to a scan that was done by somebody else on a different machine, a different clinic. So my research led me to believe that, and also from the debriefs that I've since had with multiple private midwives, is that it's just, it's a very flimsy argument for induction, and I agree. I had a debrief with a different obstetrician because I wanted to know from another obstetrician's point of view if what happened was on the up and up. And he basically said, look, you'd get a room full of obstetricians and 50% would say she did the right thing and the other 50% would say it was a bit much. I didn't get anywhere there. And I sort of wanted a debrief of a more nurturing nature. So I contacted a private midwife. It was there that I learned how so much of it was unnecessary. And then I've been on a journey of trying to heal this hurt, but I had a debrief with Debbie Gould from How to Heal a Bad Birth as well. And it was my intention that I would hire a private midwife for my second baby to take as a support person to hospital.
Just before we move on to George's pregnancy, you mentioned that you made a complaint to the obstetrician. Was that a formal complaint?
Yes. Yes. So I made a formal complaint to her, to the hospital, and also to APRA. If I'd known more, I probably would have declined the induction, but there is a possibility I would have accepted it anyway. But my argument was that there was no informed consent. I really didn't know what an induction was and what was happening and what the risks of that induction were. Luckily, none of the really horrible things that can happen in an induction happened, but there was no, warning about the cascade of interventions within an induction. There was no, especially in Australia, where the failed induction rate is almost at 50% and certainly is at that particular hospital that I was at. There was no mention of that. I really would have thought twice about it because she did offer me to come in on a daily basis to have Jean checked and to do non-stress tests and CTG monitoring. And, you know, looking back, that's the option I should have taken, but she sort of put the other option of induction to me as a, you know, it ain't no thing, you know, better out than in, let's just do it.
I think the other thing is once you do reach to that 39 week, you really are at the point where you're at the end of your tether. I mean, physically, you know, you're getting exhausted and all the rest of it. So the idea of, you know, better out than in and let's get things moving, yeah, is quite attractive, especially when it comes from someone.
You're so vulnerable as well. You're so vulnerable at that time. I'm lucky that she never mentioned anything about getting stretch and sweeps done because my sister-in-law was like, oh, get a stretch and sweep. And now knowing what I know about stretch and sweeps, I'm very glad that I was never offered that because I probably would have said yes. And the thought of that now just makes my skin crawl.
So we're at a point now where it was your intention to hire a private midwife to support you in a hospital birth for your next pregnancy. How did you decide to make that a home birth?
I was still pretty, I guess, brainwashed, you know, medically brainwashed. That, you know, that a hospital is where you have a baby and, you know, having a home birth was for hippies, I guess, which I'm sorry to anyone. No. If you're offended by that, that is not how I feel now. And that was completely ignorant of me. Yeah. I sort of started a journey of research and learning and discovering birth physiology and followed a billion podcasts. I found Dr. Stu's podcast. And when I found out that there was an obstetrician out there doing home births, I knew that something wasn't right. A, something's wrong with our maternity system, and B, that home birth is safe. And so that flicked a switch in me, and I knew from then on that I was going to have a home birth. My husband was not too happy with that idea though.
What was your husband saying about it?
Well, he had the mentality of it's not safe, only hippies do it. And my argument was I'm never going back to a hospital to give birth. That's never going to happen. He slowly came around. Once we met with our midwives, he just got on board, which was I was so thankful for. And that's how I came to be a home birther.
You already met with a midwife before falling pregnant with George.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. And so when you fell pregnant with him, I imagine, did you ring them up straight away and say, we're doing this?
Yes. My preferred midwife wasn't available. My second was unavailable. And then she emailed me and said that a new midwife had joined the practice just recently and would I want to meet with her. And we met with her and then we just knew that she was the midwife for us.
How did that relationship compare to the relationship you had with your first obstetrician?
There's no comparison. It was peer-to-peer. It was not a doctor sitting there with a stethoscope around their neck telling you what you should do, basically fear-mongering you into a range of things you potentially might not want. For example, I did all of the tests for Jean. I did GBS. I did the glucose, all of it, because I was told to do that, so I did it. I didn't look into anything about it. Why would I do it? Why would I not do it? What are the risks? What are the benefits? What are the alternatives? Doctor said I should do it, so I did it. But with midwives, it was more of a reciprocal relationship. And, you know, they would give me the risks, benefits and alternatives of absolutely everything. And I already knew so much that I already knew what I would accept and not accept. But there was nothing but informed consent with my midwives. It was completely pole opposite of my relationship with my doctor.
In this pregnancy, did you do anything differently in terms of preparation?
Yeah, I did a hypnobirthing course. I did chiro. I did osteo. I did spinning babies, the daily exercises of spinning babies. And then later on, I did all of the breech flipping maneuvers. I did moxibustion to try and get him to flip from breech. Turn breech at 30 weeks, and a known breech presentation can derail a home birth. So I was not going to have that happen. So I spent a lot of time upside down in the last 10 weeks.
And how did you go? Did he end up turning?
He did. He may have turned by himself, but I ended up having him turned via external cephalic version. I contacted my transfer hospital to ask about that. And they refused. They said that no obstetrician would do an ECB on a VBAC. And then I asked them, knowing full well that there were, you know, well, who can you recommend? And they just said, nobody. There isn't anyone who would do that for you. And so I feel really awful about that because I had prior knowledge and, you know, I knew what I was talking about. But, you know, any other consumer would just potentially give up at that point, which makes me really sad. So at 39 weeks, I had an ECV with a private obstetrician and really want to see an obstetrician, but I really, really wanted a home birth. So I went in. I didn't need any of the...
Oh, the muscle relaxant?
Yeah, the muscle relaxant. I didn't need that, thank goodness. And it was just more of a nudge popped right in. I probably could have done it myself. So that was a huge relief. Because I would have probably, if he didn't turn, I would have had to have gone to a hospital.
Were you ever concerned about uterine rupture?
Never. I'd done my research. I'm obviously aware that there's the risk, but, you know, when you really look into it, there's higher risks of things, other things happening. There was higher risks of other things happening in my induction. I could have had a uterine rupture in my induction on a uterus that didn't have a scar. So... No, I was happy with the risk versus benefit and I really trusted my care providers that they would see it coming. I think I got to 41 weeks and it was still head down, which was fantastic. I had a discussion with my midwives about, you know, what happens if it does go further. You know, what would I be willing to do in terms of monitoring? And my midwife had a discussion with my transfer hospital about me coming in after 41 weeks to have some monitoring done. And their reaction was, she's 41 weeks. She needs to come in for an induction. And
I can imagine how that would have made you feel at that point. Yeah.
And they asked her to contact me and find out how I felt about that. And I was just, no. And there was a bit of a back and forth with this person about, you know, how I really needed to come in for an induction because I was 41 weeks and I was expecting probably go to about 42. And I know the average for a first time mum is 41 plus 3, I think. And lo and behold, 41 plus 3, I started losing my mucus plug. I really wanted to call up that registrar and say, I don't need your production now. Thank you very much.
Anything, any niggles after that?
No, no niggles, but there was a lot of plug. I didn't, because it never happened to me before. I was quite shocked at the amount, and it just kept coming for a couple of days. And every night, go to bed thinking, okay, I'm going to wake up with contractions, and no, and more plug. Another day, waiting for contractions. No, more plug. this is crazy. It's like the never-ending plug.
You were obviously in touch with your private midwife, keeping her updated with all of this.
Yes, yes. I was also keeping my doula updated because I was leaving nothing to chance. So
right. So you had a doula as well for this
yes.
birth.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had, she's my doula photographer. So I had all the body work known to mankind done, and I had a doula, and I had two midwives because they work in a team. I was not leaving anything to chance.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, sorry to take you back a little bit. Did you have, so you mentioned your husband was on board. What about your close circles?
No, they still don't know. I have two close friends who know, and a friend that I met through the induction of labor Facebook group that I joined to get knowledge about what had happened in my induction.
No family members?
Nope. Yeah, I really still do want to sort of shout it from the rooftops, but for now I'm just leaving it as is.
Did you want to take us now to George's birth and how everything unfolded?
Yeah, I think it was about 3 days later after I started losing my mucus plug. I put my daughter to bed. We watched a bit of Netflix and I was dilly-dallying, I remember. I don't know why. My husband was already in bed and I was just taking my sweet time. And then I started contracting and I thought, oh, fantastic. This has never happened to me before. Spontaneous labor is here. I've done it. I texted all my people. Then I quickly realized, oh, gosh, I really should listen to the advice that everyone says, which is to go to sleep. So I promptly put myself to bed, but it got to a point where I couldn't ignore it anymore. So it was the middle of the night by that point, and I thought, well, I can't bake a cake because I know you're supposed to do things like bake a cake or go to the hairdresser, you know, just ignore it for as long as you can. So I decided to sneak into my bathroom, put on a YouTube video, and do my makeup. So this is about 1 a.m, I think. And I'm not talking about, you know, just, you know, barely there makeup. I'm talking about like full smoky eye and
wow,
curled my hair. And
what an awesome labor project.
It was fantastic. You know, contraction would come and I'd sort of hold onto the bench and stop what I was doing and then go away and get back to my blending and my eyebrows.
Did you do some contouring in there?
I didn't go full contour, no. I had time to curl my hair, so I curled my hair. I thought I wanted to look perfect for my birth photographer. So I went back into my room and sort of leant against my side of the bed with some pillows stacked up to just sort of sway into it and get into the groove, I guess. Put my hypnobirthing to the test.
And did you feel at that point you were managing the pain? Of course, because you hadn't experienced the natural contractions. So how did those contractions compare to your induction contractions?
Oh, miles apart. Obviously, it was just early labor, but it was completely different. And I got a break in between the contractions, which I never got with the induction. I loved it, really. Oddly, had all the tools, the, you know, sort of psychological mental tools in my toolkit to draw on, affirmations, and I didn't really use affirmations too much though. And breathing was, in the end, it was the breathing from hypnobirthing that I really connected with. Yeah, so that went on through the night, and then I'd sort of contacted my midwives to say, over the night, to say it was really cracking. So Jean woke up in the morning to go to kinder, and it sort of, the contractions sort of fizzled out. They were still there, but they were much more manageable. I was thinking that they would pick up again, and they did a bit. One of my midwives came over, my doula came over, and we did some body work and started setting up the pool, just because it was easier to have it set up. It wasn't time for the pool or anything. I went for a few walks. I tried the curb walking. My doula had to go off to another birth, and my midwife went off to a friend's house nearby to have a rest, have a sleep. And they pretty much just assured me that as the night wore on, the contractions would come back. That old chestnut about, you know, labour happening in dark places, dark and quiet, secluded places. And that didn't really happen. I was still contracting pretty hard and still using the hypnobirthing to get through it, but it just wasn't quite getting there. I tried a Walsh's maneuver. So that's when baby isn't engaging and you sort of, it's on the Spinning Babies website, you sort of lie on a bench or a table with your legs sort of hanging down to the ground whilst contracting. I was willing to try anything, and I tried that for two contractions and that was it. That was all I was willing to do. That was pretty intense. Earlier on in the day, I had my Webster chiro come over, and she gave me an adjustment in my living room, which was great. I was a little tight on one side, so she worked on that. And baby was in all kinds of positions throughout my labor, just moving around, trying to find that sweet spot. And I was trying to help him as much as I could. There was no move left unturned. So that was 24 hours. The next day, I was still contracting pretty hard, but it just really wasn't getting there.
Were you dilating at this point?
I declined.
You made that decision not to have the cervical check. And did that relate in any way back to the experience of your first birth?
Well, there were many reasons, really. Yeah. So one, your cervix isn't a crystal ball.
Yes.
it can be 1 centimeter and then 10 an hour later. So I didn't want cervical checks for that reason. Two, it can introduce an infection. So early on in labor, I wasn't interested in that, taking that risk. And three, the invasiveness of them. Even though I really, really trusted my midwives, I really didn't want fingers inside my vagina unless it was absolutely necessary. So there had started to be some discussion of potentially transferring to our transfer hospital to get things going, to have some Cinto. And my husband and I discussed that and decided that it was too soon. My midwife thought the sooner we went, the better. The more options would be available, the more things that the hospital would be willing to do. I just couldn't stomach going and sort of giving up that soon. I sort of felt it was a sort of giving up at that point. And I just dreaded the thought of, you know, what they would try to coerce me into in hospital, even though I had a pretty watertight birth plan, and I wasn't ready for that yet. We said no to the transfer, but yes to a cervical check. Not really to determine dilation, but more of a finding out of the position of the baby, which I don't think obstetricians are sort of, they're not really focused on that. They're focused on the dilation part. Because when I did meet with my obstetrician to complain, I asked that. I said, what was the effacement like? You know, what were the other signs? And I think she said I was almost fully effaced. I'm like, well, I was getting there then. It's not just about the 3 centimeters, the dilation. So I accepted the cervical check to assess all those other different things, and things seemed to be moving along. So, and we got his position, and then we decided to do some movement in relation to that position.
What position was he in? Sorry.
LOT, I think. So he was asynclitic again, which was a bit of PTSD. Asynclitic and LOT. So we were trying to get him to tilt his chin down to get into that perfect position. But I think at this point I was 5 centimetres, even knowing dilation doesn't really mean anything, but hearing 5 centimetres, I was just, wow, I was overjoyed. Having only got to 3 with Jean, that was an achievement in itself. So, you know, I knew things were working. We decided to call a second midwife in just for a bit of a change in dynamic, I guess. because the second midwife was the midwife that I really sort of clicked with. So she came in and the mood totally changed. It was uplifted and I really felt things were starting to turn the corner, I guess, which was amazing. So she suggested a walk. Contractions were starting to really ramp up again. I must have looked hilarious walking around the park and stopping every few minutes and making mooing sounds and, you know, it was dog walkers, and here I am, like, stopping to moo. And we were on our way back from, like, the second lap around, and I was sort of holding myself, like holding my belly during some of the contractions, and I felt a bit of an indentation. I felt a dip in my stomach. I couldn't see it, but I could feel something there. And it turns out that was probably the beginnings of a Bandel's ring, because at this point I'd been contracting for about 24 hours, a bit longer than 24 hours. And so we came back from that walk and discussed transfer again, but I sort of felt that there was a little bit more that we could do at home. We got the chiro back in, and just before the chiro came in, I decided to get another cervical check just so if we were to transfer, we sort of knew where we were at, because I trusted their assessment a little bit more than I trusted the hospital's assessment. During that check, my waters broke. So they'd already broken earlier the day before. So it already had ruptured membranes for over 24 hours, but it was just a hind water leak. Even that was exciting as well. Just having that hind water leak and not having my membranes artificially ruptured was just, I don't know, high five to me.
Yes.
I had that VE, rest of the membranes released as my gyro was knocking on my door. So I had that adjustment whilst gushing water. She was really cool with it. She's like, I can wipe this down as plastic. Don't worry about it.
So, how many centimetres were you during that VE?
I was still 5. And then the one before we transferred, spoiler alert, I had to transfer to hospital. I was 7. So I had the adjustment and my midwife cranked up my Spotify 90s playlist.
Yes.
Nice.
And I think the first 2 songs were Britney Spears was number 1. Baby One More Time, I think. And then Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
And so there's me and my midwife dancing to Britney and Backstreet Boys, really getting into it. My husband looking on like, oh, God. I married a teeny bopper. I mean, he knew that already. And I think I got to through 2 songs and then it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, oh, this is what active labor is like. And it was really on. I just couldn't. I needed to focus at that point. Richard was doing the pool, getting the water nice and warm. I went over to the bathroom and I was holding onto the doorway and I just started sobbing uncontrollably. It was just an overwhelming feeling of just emotions. There was nothing attached to it. It was just emotions. And I was sobbing and laughing in between the sobbing because everyone's like, why are you crying? And I'm like, I don't know why I'm crying. I don't know, this deep primal roar, I guess, inside me. It was amazing. It ruined my makeup.
Oh, that smoky eye.
My poor smoky eye. Why didn't I use waterproof mascara? I don't know.
Did you feel now looking back that that could have been a transition point? Do you feel like that was transition or not necessarily?
I think it could have been transition. You know what? I hadn't really thought about that before. I thought that was just me really kicking into active labor, but it could have been transition because it turns out he was direct OP. So I could have, and I felt like I was pushing. So
does that mean posterior?
Yes. Yeah.
So he was facing upwards?
Yeah. So sunny side up.
Back to back.
Yeah, back to back. So we found that out at the, I wasn't having back labor though. I didn't get any of the signs that he was OP, and we didn't find that out until we got to hospital. after the weird emotions, I got into the pool and my second midwife was called and, you know, it was on. We're all like, this is happening. She's in transition or she's in active labor. We're going to have a baby soon. So the whole team was called in. My doula was back by this point and we were getting ready to have a baby. So I was in the pool, which was amazing. Any hospital that denies a woman a water birth for whatever erroneous reason is just in the dark ages, because I was a VBAC and I was in water. Oh no.
Yeah.
And I was totally fine. And no one touched me. No one touched me when I was in the water, which was amazing. I was just floating around by myself. Not that any of my providers would have touched me without my consent anyway, because that's the kind of relationship that we had. I wasn't sure how I would be in labor, because I'm a very, especially when I'm upset, I'm a very don't touch me type person. And it turns out I didn't. I didn't change. I did like the hip squeeze. That was great. But when they were trying to wipe my face off to get the track marks from my mascara off, I kept telling them, get the hell away from me. So that's embarrassing. So I went to hospital looking like that. And then the midwives were, you know, checking my pulse rate and obviously checking the baby with the Doppler. And the two of us were experiencing a bit of tachycardia. And erring on the side of caution, we decided that considering the length of the labor, which was, I think, about 36 hours at that point, the fact that my waters had been broken for so long and that there was a bit of tachycardia, we just thought, let's just err on the side of caution, which is why home birth is safe. When it's time to go to hospital, it's time to go to hospital.
Mm. And what is tachycardia?
Fast heart rate. I had my watch, I had my Fitbit on, so I'd love going back and looking at my stats for those 2 days, because I was really working hard. That was a big workout.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. At this point, I really felt like he was coming out of my butt. Luckily, I was working really, really hard. So, but in a good way. So when this decision was made to go to hospital, I didn't have the time or the energy or to think about what a devastation that was for me. And, you know, I'm pretty practical, so I'd already written a birth plan for such an eventuation, because, you know, I didn't want to have my head in the clouds about it. I knew that there was a possibility that I might have to transfer, so I came prepared. My birth plan was already on file with that hospital, which is why I picked it as my transfer hospital. I had an appointment there earlier on in my pregnancy, and they had my birth plan on file, and because I wanted that prior knowledge to be there, because I had a statement about my previous birth trauma and, you know, how I wanted to be treated. And definitely think that, you know, for the people that read my birth plan, that was definitely true. I could tell people that hadn't read it, because I went in earlier in the pregnancy for some reduced fetal movement just to have a check. This midwife called me chickadee, and I specified in my birth plan that my name is Marion and I would like to be addressed as Marion. It's just so quintessential of, you know, the infantilization of women in maternity care. Like, there's just no way they would say something like that to a man. I can't even think of a male version of chickadee. There's just no way that would ever happen. So,
how far was the hospital from your home?
About 20 minutes, but I think it only took us about 15 to get there. My midwife drove me, and then my other midwife, my doula, and my husband followed all in separate cars, a bit of a convoy. And it was at that point, the transfer point, and I know this happens to a lot of people, that I lost control. And the hypnobirthing was really, really working for me up until that sort of disruption, you know, the breathing skills that I was using. It just sort of all went out the window. And from then, my contractions went into a bit of a hyperdrive, and I had that hyperstimulation like I had with Jean. They were just on top of each other. But I got to hospital, and funny story, the midwife called me lovely. He hadn't read my birth plan yet. So I say, actually, my name's Marion. Please call me Marion. I am lovely, though. And I feel really bad as well because she was absolutely phenomenal. She was a wonderful, wonderful, I couldn't have asked for a better hospital midwife. I could not. She went off to read my extensive birth plan. I pretty much put every contingency in there as well as the alternatives to those contingencies. They hooked me up to the, no, they hooked me up to the CTG first. And this time I got a wireless one. I think the reason I didn't get a wireless one with Jean, the midwife couldn't figure out how to work it. However, this time I did, which meant I could go into the shower, which was amazing because I'd been using water pretty much the whole time as well as the hypnobirthing. So I jumped in the shower, sort of put towels down on the floor and got on all fours, and because he was still trying to come out my butt at that point. Oh, I don't know what the point of CTGs are, to be honest with you, because it was losing contact as well with my movements. If I was going to have a birth in hospital, I was going to decline continuous monitoring. And the only reason I accepted it when we transferred was because we transferred for tachycardia. So I really wanted to make sure baby was okay. So we really needed to get a baseline, really needed it to work. And it just was not working in the positions that I was in. The hospital midwife was amazing. She tried every which way in the shower with me. So she was saturated. Shoes, everything, which is really touching, to be honest, because that's the kind of treatment I expected to get at the private hospital the first time around. I was expecting that kind of solidarity and being with me and helping me, which is why I guess I didn't prepare myself enough for Jean's birth, because I thought I would have someone helping me. I would have those expert midwives who would tell me what to do, I guess. That was my mistake. But this midwife, she was in the shower with me, coaching me through contractions, even though I had my own team of people with me there as well, because at this point, Richard, two midwives and a doula were also with me. So I'm very thankful that this baby came before the COVID-19 restrictions. I can't even imagine what it's like to birth in a hospital right now. I don't even want to think about it, to be honest, because I needed that support network. I think all women should be afforded that kind of support network. I'm just lucky that I can afford it because everyone should have that. So the CTG was losing contact, so I needed to get back in the bed, the dreaded bed, which was basically torture because I'd lost my control and it was awful. I was starting to get into that mindset that I'd been in with Jean where I'd left the building. Georgie was doing okay. It wasn't that bad. Although continuously the CTG just was not getting his trace. It was often getting my heart rate, which was pretty high, which is really frustrating. So yeah, I got back into the shower. I had a bleed, a pretty big one with a contraction. And my husband called the team in and alerted them to what was going on. They got me out of the shower. And as I went back to the bed, I was standing on some towels and I kept bleeding, just kept coming out. Oh, going back a bit, obviously when the registrar came in, her first offer was a cesarean and I immediately declined that. I was like, no, thank you. What else can we do? They also wanted to put the scalp clip on without explaining to me what a scalp clip was, but I already knew. So thankfully, just the way that I can't believe they're allowed to call it a scalp clip. Like, what does it clip to? No, it's a screw that screws into your baby's head. And I really didn't want that kind of invasive monitoring. So I declined that. They were pretty good. We requested that every time they suggested something that they leave so I could discuss it with my team. At that point, and I really didn't want to have a cannula, but at that point I was feeling really, really dehydrated. I was feeling really thirsty, even though I'd been drinking all the way through. And they realised I'd stopped going to the toilet as well, which is not a good thing. So I accepted the cannula and some hydration. So she said that sometimes a drip can help a stalled labour. So I thought, okay, great. We'll go for that. That's the least invasive sort of thing. And she was really happy with how everything was going at that point. Obviously, they wanted to do a cesarean because that's just what they want to do, but she didn't think that Georgie was in any danger at that point or anything like that. All the way through, even up to the point where it wasn't at the point where he was in fetal distress at all. So that was really good. I'm happy for that. probably would have felt a bit bad if I'd pushed it to that limit. So after the bleed, I had a VE and there hadn't been any progress. So again, not something I put too much stock in. She said 5 centimetres, my midwife had earlier said 7. So, but it was 5 centimetres twice throughout the hospital admission. So that, along with a clot, along with the bleeding, and the fact that he was OP and I was pushing and I was only at their estimation 5 centimetres.
Did you have the urge to push?
Yeah, yes, definitely feeling the urge to push. And my medical notes say, from the midwife, say, sounding pushy. I feel like I was pushing for a lot longer than when they wrote sounding pushy. So I think I've been trying to push for a couple of hours already, not really knowing that that was the sensation I was feeling. I've done all the movements, all the positions, all the spinning babies, all the chiro, and it's just, he was just essentially stuck. And I know that, you know, a lot of people have cesareans for a stuck baby, finding out later on that there was a whole, you know, host of things that they could have done to unstick the baby. And so one thing I feel really good about is that I tried everything. I knew everything. And I had care providers that didn't just go, oh, he's stuck, let's have a C-section. So in my heart of hearts, I know I did everything I could to get him into the right position and he just wasn't doing it.
It really sounds like you absolutely did. And so from that point then, when was the decision made to go for the repeat C-section?
Before the bleed, I was finally able to let everyone know that I wanted, even my private midwives, that I wanted an epidural because I was really against that. I didn't want that for me. I didn't want that for my breastfeeding journey. I didn't want that for the baby. I wanted basically no intervention, no VEs, nothing. And I was saying to myself, I want an epi, I want an epi, I want an epi. I just want to be able to think because I couldn't think. I wasn't able to sort of really put together a rational thought. And so in my mind, I was like, if I have the epidural, I'll be able to think and I'll be able to make decisions. But I was stuck in my head. So I didn't actually let anyone know that that's what I wanted. And then I finally did. And the anaesthetist came in to talk about getting the epi so we could try for a vaginal birth. So they really, really did pretty much everything they could to help me get a vaginal birth as per my birth plan. But after the bleeding and his position and it was all sort of stacking up. Oh, and then at that point, I also said I was having pain in between contractions in my uterus. And during one of the VEs, I think they noticed that my bladder was swollen as well. And the pain in between contractions isn't normal. I probably should have voiced that much earlier because I was having that pain at home as well on the second day when I was in the birth pool. I just thought it was, you know, fatigue, uterine muscle just getting sore and overworked. Turns out that's not the case. So all these things sort of stacked up and we thought it was time to pull the plug, which was a really hard decision, but it was made for all the right reasons this time. And Georgie was still doing really well. He wasn't distressed or anything like that. He was still trying to get out, just really awkwardly. This time I had my doula and my husband come with me while I was being prepped. The only time they weren't with me, and in hindsight I probably should have insisted on it, was when they were putting the spinal in. At that point, because the contractions were on top of each other and I'd lost my mojo, I was like, just get it done. This needs to stop now. If I'm having a C-section, this pain needs to stop. But oh God, I can't fault the anaesthetists. They were actually really fantastic. Talked me through everything, complete informed consent. That was just a really good experience. I was really happy with that. And so both my husband and doula were in theatre for the operation, for the C-section. The obstetrician performing the C-section, I asked her to, you know, tell me what she was doing as she was doing it, which was really good. I just remember that awful tugging feeling of, you know, what are they doing down there? And with my first, obviously, there was no commentary or anything. And I heard the obstetrician say, there's a Bandel's ring. And I didn't really think about that at the time, but I'd actually come across just in my research that term and what that meant. And so after Georgie was born, I did a deep dive and finding as much information as I could about it. And there's not a lot of information out there, but basically it's a constriction ring around the middle part of the uterus. So between the upper portion that's, you know, contracting down and then the lower segment, and it sort of contracts inwards and then babies get stuck in it. So either their head gets stuck or their shoulders get stuck, and then it also really thins out the lower segment. So my lower segment was super thin, but you know, that can happen anyway. And there was that constriction ring, so he was never getting out, unfortunately. So we made the right decision in the end. I'm actually surprised that we couldn't see it on me, because the pictures that I've seen, you can see women with this indentation in their belly, but I could feel it during that walk in the park, but you couldn't actually see it because nobody noticed, not my private midwives or any of the hospital staff. It was only on opening me up that they found it. So, and it's also one of those chicken egg sort of situations. Did I have a Bandel's ring because of the long labor, or did the long labor cause the Bandel's ring? Afterwards, I had a debrief with an obstetrician at the hospital, and he said it's because of the long labor.
Is that the reason for the pain that you experienced in between the contractions?
Yes, that, and the fact that my bladder had swollen. So the lower segment was, yeah, pushing on my bladder, and it was getting pounded basically, and it was just swelling up.
How did you come to meet George?
Oh, that's a little bit tough too, because obviously I didn't want to have that second cesarean. So that was really tough, sort of trying to make sure that they honoured all of the things that I wanted in terms of delayed cord clamping, which they did. So I wasn't in the moment, because I was A, really tired, and, you know, hopped up on some epidural drugs. And I was trying to make sure that all of the things that I knew would benefit him to keep him healthy. And if I couldn't have a vaginal birth, you know, I wanted to have at least everything, all the other benefits. So he did have delayed cord clamping. Apparently it stopped pulsating. So it was only 45 seconds, but apparently it stopped pulsating. So that was a win. Really bummed I didn't get to see my placenta. I've seen pictures of it. Didn't think of it at the time to ask to see it, so that's a bit of a bummer. He didn't come to me immediately for skin to skin. He needed a little bit of help breathing, so he went across to the resuscitator. I am a bit disappointed that obviously they're not up with the research, or they don't have the skills to do resuscitation whilst skin to skin and whilst attached to the cord. He came to me about a minute later, full skin to skin though, which was fantastic, but that only lasted a minute and he needed to go back. So whilst I did get some things, I didn't get others. And I hope, you know, that that particular hospital does, you know, catch up to the research and is able to do that. I mean, I don't know why he necessarily needed to go to a little table that was, you know, too far for me to see. They did move it closer for me, which was great. And again, because he needed help, a little bit of help, he needed to go to the special care. So we were separated again, but luckily my doula was with me the whole time and the anaesthetic team talked me through everything. One of them was really funny, and despite me being a little bit salty, I was okay with that. He put on his phone and played Claire de Lune for me, because I was feeling pretty anxious about being separated, and it took quite a long time to put me back together. I don't know whether that was just them being thorough, or, you know, there weren't really any complications.
Were you feeling okay physically at this point?
No, I had the shakes again, but this time they explained it to me, which was, it's just such a simple thing, but the explanation of why I was shaking and why the body does that, and, you know, that it's not going to last, and would you like something for it? You know, I didn't necessarily want to take any drugs, but, you know, just that care and consideration, just worlds apart from my private hospital experience. And then I think it was an hour and a half, which really was a real bummer. I was reunited with Georgie and put him straight to the breast. So skin to skin, put him straight on, and
that was a completely different to my experience with Jane.
Was Richard with Georgie? Was he with you?
Yes. So he went with Georgie to special care along with both of my midwives, but my doula stayed with me. And then once Rich and Georgie were settled in special care, they finally went home to go to sleep because it was about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at this point.
I just wanted to read something that you'd written, which I feel is a really important message. Am I disappointed that it ended in C-section again? I'm pretty devastated. Am I disappointed that I tried to have a vaginal birth instead of going straight to a repeat C-section or labouring in hospital? No. My baby and I got all the benefits of a spontaneous labour that almost worked, and I was supported and respected along the way. That went a long way to healing the hurt of my first birth. I don't regret giving it my best shot. My labour was amazing and powerful, even though it didn't end in vaginal birth.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell. I write better than I speak. But it's definitely my advice is that give it a shot, you know. And, yeah, I'm devastated. I really am. And I might not get over, you know, this birth either, but it's different this time. I took control of it. I stood up for me and my baby. And no matter the outcome, I did it on my own terms. And I really hate that, you know, when people say, help, you know, as long as you've got a healthy baby at the end, that's only half the picture. And the way you give birth really matters. The way you feel really matters. And the way you're looked after really matters. And that's my advice, is to take control and make sure you have care providers who are on the same page as you. And unfortunately, not a lot are. So you've got to be really, really picky. And you're worth it. So be picky.
It's really inspirational, your story. As you said, you really did give it your all. And it's also a testament to how, you know, things don't always go to plan, even if you've tried absolutely everything. And really, the main difference, and when I was listening to you speak, was you were speaking so positively about your attempted VBAC in comparison to your first birth. And I think the main difference there was how well supported you were. You had your midwives, your doula, and even the staff at the hospital really did try to follow your birth wishes or your birth plan. And I think that's really a good example for, you know, other hospitals to take on board and care providers here. Just that informed consent is so important, and making you feel in control of the situation, even when you can't control the outcome.
Yeah. I always hear that you shouldn't write a birth plan because you can't control birth, but that's not the point of a birth plan. The point of a birth plan is for you to be as educated as you possibly be. You can be about birth, about what can happen, and about what you want if X happens, if Y happens, if Z happens, rather than just sort of getting to a point where, you know, your agency is taken away from you because you didn't know that this was something that could happen and that you didn't know that you had choice A, B, C, or D, and so your care providers choose for you. So ladies, write a birth plan, a really, really militant birth plan.
You're 4 months postpartum now. So really, yeah, not that long ago. And how are you feeling now? And how's George at home with Jeannie? And
I just love him so much. It's so beautiful to watch. It's funny. I thought Jean was a difficult baby. George is rewriting the history on difficult babies. Love him so very, very much, but he's really tricky. So he's keeping on with that. Yeah, Mum, I'm doing it my way. He's certainly doing it his way, but he's adorable. Absolutely adorable.
You mentioned in your written birth story that you wouldn't be having any more children.
No, this, Two is our limit. So that's also what makes it a bit of a pill to swallow, because I won't have the opportunity to try again. I never really thought that it wouldn't happen for me. It never even entered my mind that I really would have to go transfer to hospital and have another C-section. It never crossed my mind, and I'm glad of that, because there was no seed of doubt at any point. That's just what had to happen in the end. But if I knew then that it was going to end this way, I still would have done it. I still would have gone through with everything. It was amazing. The antenatal care, it was, you know, Jean helping out with my blood pressure, and I've got photos of her with the midwives helping out. And yeah, it was just a world of difference and experience, both antenatally and during labor. Then my first, that sort of cold, sort of standoffish, matter of fact doctoring compared to the love and support I got from my midwives. It's just worlds apart.
I just wanted to say thank you for speaking with us. I know it's really hard to go over those stories and to go over everything that happened. It's a really difficult thing. I can only hope in sharing your story that there's other women out there who are in the same position, and I hope that they can take away, you know, a lot of knowledge from the sharing of your story and a lot of understanding there. Yeah.
I really hope so, because the podcast that I listen to, all the birth stories, the good, the bad, the ugly, I wanted to hear it all, and they all helped. So hopefully I can do the same for someone else.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.